Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2006, beekeepers reported losses of 30 to 90% of their hives. Since then, scientists, environmentalists, and more recently, government officials have been trying to figure out what is killing the bees, one of the most critical pollinators in our ecosystem. A quarter of our diets, including apples, cherries, onions, almonds, and so many other things, depends on honeybee pollination. In the past few years, a number of studies found a link between neonicotinoid pesticides and the escalation of honeybee colony losses. In 2013, the European Food Safety Authority, which is the EU's food safety watchdog, imposed an EU-wide ban on the use of three types of pesticides linked to a decline in bee health. The ban, which was hailed by environmentalists as a victory, is now under review. And then back in the U.S., earlier this month, the U.S. EPA came out with its first risk assessment, calling imidacloprid, a nicotine chemical found in at least 188 farm and household products in California, quote, potentially poses a risk to hives when the pesticide comes in contact with certain crops that attract pollinators, end quote. So what does that mean exactly? We'll talk about that on today's show. And now that we know this, what is next? How can we save the bees? Joining us to talk about the bees are two guests. Paul Towers is the spokesman for the Pesticide Action Network, an organization working to reduce the use of hazardous pesticides around the globe. And Paul Towers joins us on the line from Sacramento. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Amay Code, Pesticide Program Director at the Xerces Society, an international nonprofit dedicated to protecting the diversity of life through the conservation of invertebrates and their habitat. And Amay Code joins us from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Amay. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
It's great to have both of you. So we've done a lot of shows about bees over the years, and it seems like a number of reports come out every few months. So it would be so great if both of you could put all of this into context for us. And Amay, you wrote a blog post back in November about one report, a really important one, that came out from the U.S. Geological Survey. And it was a study evaluating pesticide exposures to native bees foraging in agricultural fields and grasslands. And you write that the results were startling. Of the bees tested, 70% contained pesticides. In total, 18 pesticides were detected in bees. So tell us about this report and its significance.
You know, I think what's most important about it is that it's one of the first times we've looked not just at our honeybees, but at our native bees here. We actually have about 3,600 species of bees in the U.S. And we were trying to understand not just what's happening to bees that are managed, that are moved around from agricultural fields, but what about the bees that live there in those fields and in the kind of more natural grasslands that are close by. And what was so startling was that there were extremely high levels of multiple pesticides found in these bees. Obviously, we didn't find lethal levels because the tests could not have collected the bees had they already died. So our concern is that this research is showing these low-level effects that are happening to bees with exposure to these pesticides. And so now the concern is these chemicals are definitely in the bees. What's happening to them?
Right.
We already know that about a quarter of our bumblebees are at risk of extinction. What else is going on? So it's very concerning.
And so, I mean, where are we today? Because beekeepers started talking about this back in 2006, and they were reporting losses of between about 30 to 90% of their hives. Where are we almost 10 years later?
Paul, do you want to, or should I?
Amay, go ahead.
Okay. You know, I think the debate is changing, the knowledge level is changing, but the reality is our bees are still at risk, and we're learning more and more about the complex systems that are causing the harm. And I think, I really hope that at this point, 10 years later, we know enough to act and to make changes. And at times I see we are, but at other times I feel like we're a little too cautious and not willing to take the steps we need to. We're still seeing an average of a 40% loss of honeybees every year. That's the highest we've seen, and that was the most recent data.
Wow.
So clearly the problem isn't going away.
Why? What do you mean when you say we're a little too cautious?
Yeah, I think there's a – I feel like we need to take – you know, people are back and forth. Oh, well, do we have enough knowledge to take action? Do we know definitively what's going on? And if we don't know definitively, we shouldn't ask. We shouldn't act. And I think we need to take a more an approach where we recognize there is a problem and act to protect before it's too late.
Paul, do you also agree? Do you believe that we're taking – we're too cautious? Because you have said that this new EPA report only provides a piecemeal view of the threat.
Well, I think that's right. And this has been the history of the regulatory system in California and in the United States at large. There has been, and it's a system that's benefited, you know, a handful of corporations, and in this case, pesticide corporations, those like Bayer or Syngenta. What happens is these companies work to bring a product to market, a neonicotinoid like imidacloprid, which you spoke to earlier. And what happens is, you know, there's very little study or research on the front end looking at what the impacts might be on any number of species, including bees. So a product is brought to market very quickly, and then it's many years later before the body of independent science can catch up and really showcase or demonstrate what the full range of harms is. In the case of bees, what has become clear is that in many cases, these pesticides, this new class or newer class of pesticides doesn't kill bees outright, but renders them susceptible to other problems or sufficiently weakens them or damages communication or reproduction in ways that our system, our current regulatory system, is really just built around an understanding of what kills something outright, what is the lethal dose. And so this has been the real problem and the real flaw that we've seen with the understanding of these products, is that our current system isn't built to really understand that and thus take the right and necessary steps to make sure that these, really the underpinnings of our food system, are necessarily protected.
And
I think that's what we've seen.
And what did you think of the significance of the U.S. Geological Survey that found of the bees tested, 70% contain pesticides?
Well, I think this is the reality. You know, bees, they are the canaries of today, right? They're the canaries in our modern food system. They're really these vulnerable creatures pointing out what's happened with industrial food and farming. This, you know, in tremendous introduction of chemicals, chemical inputs, in this case pesticides, in other cases fertilizers, that really sped up dramatic production of food. And what we see is that bees and what's being found in their wax and in their bodies, in their hives, that range of pesticides, and particularly these neonicotinoids, but the chemical cocktail of what's out there is showing up in ways that really do indicate that there is a lot going on, a lot of this chemical cocktail being mixed out in farm fields, in ways we're only beginning to understand.
So the report that just came out from the EPA focused on this insecticide called imidacloprid. And it acts as an insect neurotoxin, and it belongs to a class of chemicals called the neonicotinoids, which acts on the central nervous system of the insect. Amay, can you help us understand what the EPA, what the report found? Can you help me understand here? It says that chemical found in at least 188 farm and household products in California potentially poses a risk to hives when the pesticide comes in contact with certain crops that attract pollinators. Now, what does that mean exactly?
It is very cautiously worded, isn't it? It's very basically, what they found is that at the levels they believe will be in the environment, with the application methods that might be out there, that some crops will cause, that use this chemical will cause harm to pollinators. But Paul used the appropriate term of piecemeal. They looked crop by crop at the potential harm without looking at the broader reality that bees aren't just exposed to a single crop. They also decided what level a bee might be exposed to, and they put a pretty high level that might potentially cause harm. And I'm concerned when I read that risk assessment of imidacloprid that they really, how can I put this? They're, when the scientists are out there that are doing research on bees are finding levels causing harm much lower than what EPA said would cause harm. It's back to that issue of we look at lethality as the problem. We have these, you know, you have to have a, we react to big problems. We react to die-offs, like the almond die-off a couple years ago. Unfortunately, we aren't very good at responding to subtle effects, but the subtle effects can be extremely detrimental. So this risk assessment needs to look a layer deeper, or we're still going to have huge bee losses. And they're going to be under the radar, more hidden.
Paul, what would you add? Paul? Hello, did we lose Paul? Okay, I think we may have lost Paul. We'll get him right back. So tell us more about this pesticide, imidacloprid. According to reports, this chemical is found in about 188 farm and household products in California. Amay, what do we need to know about this? What's it found on?
Well, the reality is imidacloprid came onto the market in the mid-90s, and it just took off. The uses have grown exponentially. If you look at maps of the use, it went from a couple little dots across the United States to pretty much covering the map with use. We use it for many, many different crops. We use it in many ways. It's extremely long-lived. We're looking at months to years of persistence with this chemical, which means that you can, these bees and other invertebrates and other creatures can be exposed for a very long time. It's used in new ways. In the last decade, we have, in the United States, started using coated seed, dipping these seeds, corn seed, cotton seed, in neonicotinoid insecticides and then planting them in hopes that we can avoid different pests. What we're finding is that huge acreage, millions of acres across the United States are now being planted with these, with seeds that are coated. Getting into our water, it's causing harm in the soil. In fact, the estimates are that more than the size of California is coated in treated seed every year now.
Wow.
So we've got a heavy use of a very persistent, very toxic chemical. And while I think we need to do a whole system approach to protecting our pollinators and protecting our ecosystems, still we also have to hone in on priorities. And imidacloprid is a priority. We need to find ways to reduce the use, and I think they're out there too.
Paul, sorry we lost you there. We were just talking about imidacloprid and how the use of this pesticide has just exploded across the country. What else do we need to know about this particular pesticide?
Well, I think as Amay has pointed out, use has been dramatic in this country, particularly in the last decade, both everything from coated seeds to what's being used in people's backyards. In California, we use many thousands of pounds of it that are tracked in agriculture, but what we don't track and understand actually is the volume of what's actually being used in people's backyards. And so what both honeybees, native bees, or pollinators are being exposed to, we really just don't have a good grasp of it in this state. And that's part of an overall lack of really a comprehensive reporting system for how pesticides are being used and how our pollinators might be exposed out there in fields. I think, you know, the reality is imidacloprid is a common problematic insecticide. You heard about how it acts on effectively, you know, on bees' brains as a neurotoxicant. It's one of several that are now being used, even in combination with other neonicotinoid bee brain harming products out there. I was just at Home Depot over the weekend. And, you know, there was a product by Bayer that had both imidacloprid in it and another product called clothianidin. And so if a homeowner, you know, goes to purchase, they're applying these two different products or two different ingredients on their rose bush or whatever it might be. And, you know, what we do know, the independent body of science out there suggests that each of these alone pose significant threats to bee health. And in combination, we're just beginning to understand what those impacts are. And again, our current regulatory system is ill-equipped to deal with those sort of interacting effects and multiple impacts on bees out there.
What changes would you like to see from the regulatory system?
Well, I think Before these products even get to market, we need a much more robust system for evaluating their impacts, right? So in many cases, these products were brought to market, were rushed to market under these so-called conditional registrations. So conditionally, they were supposed to be brought to market after they were fully reviewed. Then there would be a decision by the federal government about keeping them on the market or what additional restrictions might be in place. But in effect, it's been a rubber stamp. These products are brought to market quickly without fully understanding their impacts and then kept on the market. So I think that's, we've got to figure out how to make sure we fully understand the impacts on bees out there in the environment and these multiple chemicals interacting at once before we allow their use. And I think really, you know, as May has alluded to it, you know, we need to make sure we're providing farmers and home gardeners with the right tools to prevent pest problems in the first place. These products are being used because there are these perceived problems with a variety of pests. There are a lot of ways to make sure those problems don't start, making sure we take care of healthy soil, making sure that, we actually plant the right crops in order, looking at the ways to sort of build the health of the entire backyard or farming ecosystem so we don't have to use these products. But when they must be used or when a product must be used, let's consider certified organic options as a last resort. So there's a full system approach to dealing with these problems rather than relying on these specific products. And we really just need to fully understand those problems and act on them.
Well, if you are a farmer or use some of these pesticides in your backyard and you have questions for Paul or Amay about what you're using, or if you'd like to talk about what you're using, we'd love to hear from you. Also, have you noticed a decline in the bee population where you are? And if you're a beekeeper, we'd also like to hear from you. What changes have you seen? We'd love to hear from you at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And also, if you have any questions about the chemicals that you're buying, it's hard enough to pronounce some of these chemicals. It's hard enough to know what's in them, of course. So if you have questions about that, give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Paul Towers, spokesman with the Pesticide Action Network, and Amy Code is the Pesticide Program Director at the Xerces Society. And Paul, you wrote a recent report in September about the federal courts taking a stand for bees. In their written decision, the judges said the EPA had approved a new pesticide, sulfoxaflor, without adequate review, and the court ordered the Dow product be pulled from the market. Can you give us an update on that?
Yeah, so this is, again, one of these related products. I think it's Amaya has described what's so unique about many of these insecticides or pesticides that we're talking about today is how they're taken up throughout the entire system of a plant, right? So these systemic insecticides are taken up through the entire sort of plant tissue, the vascular system of a plant, and expressed through the nectar, through sort of plant sweat, these gustation droplets, through pollen. So good and bad insects, if you will, like interact with all these things. And what sulfoxaflor, one of these other systemic insecticides, it was shown to act in very similar ways, and then again was brought to market without the sort of level of scrutiny that we need on many of these products. So at this point, this is one of several lawsuits that we've brought against federal EPA, U.S. EPA. For moving too quickly to bring products to market without review or for not taking them off the market once they're on. So this is sort of one notch, one victory for today of keeping a product, sulfoxaflor, off the market. Mm. We've got many more ahead of us to trying to fully make sure that the bees and other pollinators are protected.
And in terms of that process, I mean, what changes would you like to see? We've done shows just about how, chemicals in our everyday products are not tested, whether it's lipsticks or lotions. And so across the board, this is pretty common. What changes would you like to see?
Well, I think that's right. There are a lot of parallels between federal toxics law, so the Toxic Substances Control Act that deals with consumer products, the lipsticks, the baby toys, the bathtub toys, those sorts of things, And then what we see with federal pesticide law, FIFRA as it's called. And so I think a lot in both cases, there's very little scrutiny or not enough scrutiny on the front end before these products are brought to market. You know, we work with manufacturers, whether it's the pesticide companies or other chemical companies. They do the testing, they do the research, they submit the information to make sure that their product is brought. And then they really look at a very narrow set of information about what those impacts might be. They look at sort of in a sort of perfect world lab what the impacts might be on, say, bees. And ignore the real world, ignore the impacts of other products out there. There's, you know, real effort by the federal government to help bring these products very quickly to market for Bayer or for Syngenta. And so what we need to do is take the due time to consider all the impacts, because what we find is it takes many years for that independent research to catch up and understand what those impacts are. You know, it takes 30 years before we understood the impacts of DDT. It took 30 years before we understood the impacts of some of the organochlorines or organophosphate pesticides. And so the same is true now, is it took us many years to understand what those impacts might be on bees and other pollinators. And so we're just beginning to be able to fully understand that. And so I think what's important is that we take action now, make sure the protections are in place, and also don't rush to replace bees with some other harmful pesticide, some other pollinator or person. We've got a lot of responsibility to make sure we don't play that shell game, or as one of my colleagues calls it, a whack-a-mole approach. Mm. Or take down one pesticide or one product, only replace it with something potentially more harmful.
Well, Amay, how much time do we have here? Because you said that we're seeing a consistent 40% loss of bees every year.
So those are our honeybees, and recognizing that our honeybees are managed, and they've got these caregivers. Beekeepers are out there providing extra food. If they lose the queen, they're going to put a new queen in place. They're getting a lot of support, and that's a 40% drop. Our native bees don't have that. They don't have anyone out there helping them. And the other thing is, a honeybee is a huge super organism. This colony of 50,000 bees. So when I talk about a 40% drop, recognizing that our beekeepers are up there splitting colonies, creating new colonies as they can, putting in new queens, constantly providing support. If that's the drop we're seeing with that support, what are we seeing in the wild? And there's very little knowledge about that. I don't want to put a timeline on it. Our bees are amazingly resilient, but the fact that nationwide we've got more than a quarter of our bumblebee species at risk of extinction. California has put on their state wildlife action plan some of the native bees of the area, including the western bumblebee. So, California is taking some steps. Hopefully, once you get on that, once you're there, more action is taken to protect them. I don't want to put a timeline, but it is very concerning that we're constantly seeing, this kind of backwards step. We really need to be bringing our pollinators back. And, it's not just bees. It's also our monarchs. We've got monarchs moving through on the West Coast. A lot of people don't even realize we have a whole Western population. And back in the 90s, they started noticing a drop in the monarchs, and they started counting. We've got a 50% drop in our monarchs, so we need to provide support to them as well.
Well, we did a show about monarchs, I think it was last year, but I'd love to talk with you more about that after the break. Today on Your Call, we are talking about bee populations, what can be done to save the bees, and what can be done to save the monarch butterflies. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. Coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock this morning here on KALW, it's Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Time right now is 10:31.
This is Your Call. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Liz Cunningham, author of Ocean Country, One Woman's Voyage from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas. We'll find out how communities around the globe are working to save the oceans. Wednesday, we'll get the latest on the San Francisco corruption case. And Thursday, Greg Jobin-Leeds joins us to talk about his new book, When We Fight, We Win, 21st Century Social Movements and the Activists That Are Transforming Our World. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what is being done to save the bees. There has been a 40% loss of honeybees every year. More than a quarter of bumblebees are at risk of extinction. There's been a 50% drop in monarch butterflies. And today we're talking about what we're facing, how serious this is, why this is happening. Earlier this month, the EPA came out with its first risk assessment report, calling imidacloprid, a chemical found in almost 200 farm and household products in California, as potentially posing a risk to hives. So we're talking about what needs to be done about this with Paul Towers, spokesman for the Pesticide Action Network, and Amay Code, Pesticide Program Director at the Xerces Society. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. If you're a farmer, if you farm in your backyard, what pesticides do you use? If you have any questions about what you're buying at the store, we'd love to hear from you. And then if you have any alternatives, give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Amay, before we get to calls, since you brought up the 50% drop in monarch butterflies before the break, is there any new research on butterflies? What do we know now?
Well, you know, since we're talking about imidacloprid and these neonicotinoids and talking about what we can do in our own backyards, there was a very compelling study, the first study that looked at the impact of neonicotinoids on monarchs and what they're finding. So as Paul noted, neonicotinoids are systemic. They move up through the plant. That means a monarch larva that is eating a milkweed, its only host plant, that larva, and we all know about the very hungry caterpillars, these larvae are going to be eating huge quantities of these of milkweed. If they're in an area where they might be contaminated with neonicotinoids, this study showed significant concern that they would that we would see a long-term drop in monarchs because of the larva eating that milkweed. Unfortunately, some neonicotinoids are used on our milkweed plants that we might buy in a nursery. Neonicotinoids are used in fields where there could be dust and movement off of the field onto the milkweed. So our monarchs are at risk from these chemicals as well. Also, of course, nectaringers, adult butterflies. I wanted to mention in backyards, you know, if you're dealing with a pest problem or you see something's been eating at one of your bushes, don't immediately assume that you need to pick up a pesticide. Honestly, the vast majority of or if you just see a bug on your plant, oh no, I need to spray. Less than 1% of insects are even considered pests. Also, oftentimes, very low levels of these pests end up being food for other beneficial insects. So see what your backyard can do and balance on its own before you get out and spray. A study on neonicotinoids, a single application to one of your woody plants in a backyard, you could still find that chemical 6 years later in the pollen and nectar. That's what sometimes what they're showing. So, you know, it's time to stop using them because it's going to take a long time before we build ourselves out of this hole.
6 years.
It's amazing how persistent some of these chemicals are, yes.
And do we know how these chemicals affect the bees and how long those effects stay with the bees?
So, of course, you know, bee colonies are going to be living over multiple years, but our solitary bees have a shorter lifespan. They are showing that these chemicals, not only do they, you know, they can reduce a queen's ability to lay eggs. They can reduce the number of larvae that are produced. They can make foraging harder. So, you know, they did this study on bumblebees. The workers that went out, and they came back because bumblebees are in small colonies, 30% less pollen and nectar brought back, 30% less food. Mm. That's pretty significant. I mean, can you imagine bringing 30% less food to your family? It's dramatic.
Wow.
So these are the kind of effects that we're looking at. Mm.
Well, thank you for that information. That is Amay Code, Pesticide Program Director with the Xerces Society, and Paul Towers is spokesman with the Pesticide Action Network. We have full lines. Let's hear from Melody in Oakland. Hi, Melody. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for the show. I'm a member of the National Resource Defense Council, and they brought up the fact that Bayer, that produces the neonic and the two products I can't pronounce, have topped a staggering $1.5 billion in annual sales. Mm. So that is an issue where money seems to override the safety of both our butterflies and our bees. And also, Johnson & Johnson, the family company that brings us Roundup, which is also very damaging. I won't go into that, but there's a lot of things that that does. I think that these companies should be called to task for their being so irresponsible and unconcerned, where money outweighs anything else, and I'm just really concerned about that. So maybe you want to respond to that, and did you realize that Bayer is a German corporation, which is has a local office in Berkeley, and I think they need to be held accountable.
Well, thank you so much. Paul, what else do we need to know about these companies? Can you name some of the other household names? You've got Bayer, you've got Dow. What other companies?
Yeah, so the two largest manufacturers of the products that we see now are Bayer and Syngenta. Probably folks are less familiar with that name, but actually the largest pesticide corporation in the world. Now they're Swiss-based. Bayer, as you mentioned, has a East Bay office, so it's connected to the Bay Area. And then there are, you know, four other major pesticide corporations. We call them the Big Six in sum total that control actually now the majority of the pesticide and a majority of the seed marketplace. And I think that's what's so sort of sinister about this new wave of pesticides, these systemic products, these sort of whole plant products that we've been talking about. Is that they were meant and marketed as the sort of next generation of safer products. And what we've seen is, you know, quite the opposite. They've now contaminated whole plants, the soil, water, everything with them, given the kind of persistence that Amay spoke to. But it's really not surprising, you know, as there have been more restrictions on the types of other pesticides out there, these sort of ones that we grew to understand the harms of, these manufacturers, like Bayer, were looking for new delivery mechanisms, new ways to get their products out there. And as Amay spoke to, the coating of seeds really is that sort of next or was the next frontier for them. So starting in the 90s, as these corporations looked for new ways to get more and more of their product out there and grow both their seed business, which, again, they own the majority of the seed market now, as well as their pesticide market, it really served both purposes. Put more of your product on the seed, and you can sell both and make profit on both. And so that's really been the story of neonicotinoids. Neonics in particular is it is a way that serves the seed, corporate seed, and pesticide interests of these corporations to really sell both, market share in both.
What can you tell us about the lobbying efforts of these organizations? SourceWatch has information on Syngenta spending $1.2 million on average, some years $975,000, but it's around $1 million on lobbying efforts.
Well, I think, you know, the direct lobbying often is sort of a drop in the bucket compared to the aggressive public relations and marketing campaigns that these companies are running. So I spend quite a bit of my time in Sacramento, and I deal with the lobbyists that work on behalf of these corporations and some of their front groups, things like the Western Plant Health Association here, which is, you know, a misnomer, I think. So those are, you know, they have direct lobbying efforts and are trying to both delay, is often the name of the game, delay as much of the analysis or review of these products as possible. That's their biggest approach to how to deal with these. And that's why, you know, you look at the review of imidacloprid, as you spoke to, just one of the commonly used bee-harming pesticides. The review began in 2009, and we're just looking at the first real draft of it now. it takes that many years because of, in large part because of the delay and game of the lobbyists. But the public relations efforts, I think, of these corporations are really important to understand. You know, online, in press, they're running their own now BeCare centers in various parts of the country where they try to educate folks around the problems facing bees, and in particular try to redirect attention away from the problems of pesticides and towards other problems for bees. And I think that's not to say that there aren't other problems facing bees. That's true. There are problems with the lack of healthy food, with other diseases out there, but these problems have been around for some time. And what's new has been the advent of these systemic whole plant pesticides. And so I think that's been really, we've seen aggressive marketing efforts. We've seen attempts to build allegiance with academic institutions, my alma mater, UC Davis. We've seen aggressive efforts there. So there is an effort that I think we often look, you know, I think the public often focuses on the direct lobbying dollars, which we should pay attention to, but the public relations efforts are far much more expensive.
Amay, what would you add to that? What else do we need to know about the public relations efforts of these chemical companies?
Well, I just add, it's interesting to me as I read research articles how, you know, there's a lot of research dollars, you know, that are going right to evaluating the impact of these pesticides coming from chemical companies. And, you know, if you look at the message used, sometimes you really can call them into question, noting that they really aren't looking at for the deeper effects. They're avoiding certain components of the risk, and those methods are going to find less concern. And so with pesticides, a really interesting... Sorry about that. I've got to... a really interesting part of the—I've lost my train of thought.
You know what? Bring back your train of thought in a minute, because we have a bunch of questions from listeners about corporations and the role that these corporations play and the influence they have on politics. So David is a beekeeper, and he writes from Santa Cruz, "I think it's important to note how in this country our elected leaders carefully protect the cash flow and the profitability of the corporate chemical industry. Government leaders in other countries are more interested in protecting their citizens' food supply. We can see that in how these new insecticides are being regulated. Bees and pollinators are just another example of this." He writes, "This year I am voting for my food supply." Thank you for that email, David. So what about that, Amay? In 2013, the European Food Safety Authority, which is the EU's food safety watchdog, imposed an EU-wide ban on the use of three types of pesticides linked to a decline in bee health. How significant was that decision, and have we seen any changes as a result?
Well, it's still pretty early to know what kind of changes were made, but imidacloprid was one of the pesticides that was included in that ban. We are seeing, you know, reductions in certain places where these chemicals had been used. Coming back to the U.S., what's really interesting is I think part of it, I hope that what we're seeing with some of our politicians is not an outright decision to not pay attention to our food source, but I think there's a fear out there. We feel like, can we produce food for our people without these chemicals? And we need to kind of step away and recognize that, yes, we can. We can make a difference. We can have a healthier ecosystem and provide the food that our world needs. And the fear of harming our growers and not being able to produce food is so great that it stops us from doing what we need to. And that's why it's so important. You know, the Xersey Society, we've got many independent researchers that are doing applied research on the ground to find out what are the most ecologically sound methods of growing our food that aren't going to be poisoning our waters, poisoning our pollinators and ourselves. And I think that's really where we need to shift, because the fear is so great. We need to prove to these people that these systems that are ecologically sound can work. And I hope that is really how we can shift this political system.
Well, thank you for the email, David. And then, Paul, to your comment about colleges and universities, Leslie writes, "What role do they play in the research of these pesticides, and is the research sponsored by the chemical corporations?"
Well, so I think I may have alluded to this a bit. So I think, yes, particularly land-grant institutions here in California and across the country have played a big role in understanding the impacts or effects of pesticides in our larger food system. And it's played a big role in understanding the importance of bees and pollinators. And I think this is sort of the trap, unfortunately, that I think our many of our academic institutions faces with fewer and fewer public dollars available. They're relying more and more on outside corporate dollars. So you look at something like the so-called World Food Center at UC Davis. This is a largely funded sort of quasi-public, quasi-corporate branch that is largely, mostly endowed by some of the largest pesticide and chemical manufacturers. The university went to seek out dollars to support research around the food system. The same is true with some of the, with some of the other large grant institutions. Without more public dollars available, they're going outside to seek, more and more outside money. And that's true for folks conducting research on various chemical products. And we've seen that. You look at Dr. Tyrone Hayes at UC Berkeley, infamous for being sponsored to look at the impacts of one separate pesticide, atrazine, and its impacts on amphibians. And he then learned about some significant impacts on their endocrine or hormone system that the company Syngenta didn't like and asked him to not basically publish the information. He then refused and blown up into a large national scandal. But I think that's the type of pressure we see on academics is, we're going to support your research. You're looking for dollars to support your research. And then if a company doesn't like it, direct or indirect, what they're going to ask you to sort of dissuade you from or redirect your research. So I think that's, we've seen that playing out in some more public and substantial ways and some less so. But it is true. I think the change in dollars redirects the research agenda of many institutions.
Well, thank you for that. Oh, go ahead, Amay.
Just if I could quickly add, what's really interesting is our federal regulatory system has the companies that are manufacturing these pesticides submit the data that they evaluate for the impacts of these pesticides. And so our regulatory system really is one where the science they're evaluating was created by the people who have an economic benefit to show no harm. And so what you often see is that research performed for that the regulation for putting a chemical on the market is very different than the independent research. And you often find concerns when the scientists are doing their research independently that you don't see when it's submitted to the government. And that's another really concerning piece, to have kind of the fox guarding the hen house.
Well, thank you for the email, Leslie. That is Amay Code. She is Pesticide Program Director at the Xerces Society. Paul Towers is spokesman for the Pesticide Action Network. Today, we are talking about what needs to be done to save the bees. And you can join us at 866-798-8255 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Billy in Redwood City. Hi, Billy. Welcome to the show. Hello, Billy. I think we lost Billy. Billy wanted to know what scientific research is being done toward replacing bees. Who and what will do the pollinating? Amay, do you want to take that?
Well, honestly, I don't want to be the one to do the research to replace bees. I think we are not at that point yet. We have every ability to bring our bees back. Our pollinators are so vitally important. In other countries where they don't have bees, for example, in China, where they've lost so many of their pollinators, they're hand pollinating. It's extremely inefficient. In Australia, in some greenhouses, they have little machines that they use to recreate what a bumblebee could do by buzz pollinating plants to transfer. It's not where we want to go. we still have time to save our pollinators.
Well, Nina just sent in an interesting report from, let's see, the University of Vermont to publish this, and it points to a major international study in Nature Communications suggesting that only 2% of wild bee species pollinate 80% of bee-pollinated crops worldwide. And the findings offer a warning to conservation advocates, hoping that economic arguments can justify the preservation of all species. Researchers say that moral reasons are still needed. What do you think about this, Paul?
Well, I think that's it's an interesting point, and I think, you know, there's often challenges when we try to quantify the importance or value of any sort of bee or any pollinator in our food system. I think what was interesting from a study by University of Vermont recently and UC Davis is that when they looked at the top 139 ag-producing counties, they were able to show, you know, pretty significant economic value of native bees, around $3 billion in those top ag-producing counties for the food systems. I think it's right to bring up the moral imperative or the moral value of bees and pollinators in our food system. I think what works in kind of our current policy context, unfortunately, is a preponderance or focus on economic value. And so we're often left to focus on that, and we have plenty of information to show the value of it. So, you know, the $6 billion plus value of bees to the almond industry in California alone, you know, almonds will not work in California without pollination by bees. So I think we have plenty of information alone that is how policymakers in this country and abroad are making decisions. We need to continue that conversation around, you know, loss of species at the same time.
Ame, what would you add?
Well, you know, we talk about a third of our food is created by bees and wouldn't be there without bees. Just the same for our wildlife. About a quarter of the food that our wildlife need is created by pollinators. So I absolutely agree, you know, that it's totally correct. 80% of flowering plants require an insect pollinator. Think about all the amazing plants that we wouldn't have if we didn't have our pollinators. So I absolutely agree with that argument, and it is true that unfortunately sometimes in the arena of politics and policy, you also have to focus on the concrete economic component. But I work for an organization that believes that we're trying to protect the life that sustains us. We absolutely recognize the inherent value of our invertebrates.
And it's amazing to think that a single bee colony can pollinate 300 million flowers every day. It's just amazing to think about. Well, let's take a few more callers before we end. Let's hear from Jane in Corte Madera. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I think this is a wonderful program, as was your first hour. Your first hour showed what happens when man messes with nature. And what happens here in the garden is that there are good bugs and bad bugs, and the good bugs eat the bad bugs. But when you're spraying to kill the bad bugs, you're also killing the good ones. And we're upsetting the balance of nature, and I think that has a lot to do with the disappearance of all sorts of things. Hunters go out and shoot elephants for tusks, and I heard the other day that there might be an end to the elephant population on our planet. So I think that when you go to the store to buy something to eliminate something you don't like in your garden because it's eating a leaf, maybe that leaf is being eaten by a monarch caterpillar, because they do eat leaves of mostly milkweeds. And I have thousands of milkweed seeds from last year, and I'm going to scatter them around in my garden, and hopefully maybe I'll have a milkweed garden for the monarchs. I also have a resident bumblebee, and he lives in a piece of driftwood that's standing against my house, and there have been occasions when I've seen him approach it with all sorts of yellow on his body, because that's the pollen where he's been, and he and his progeny live in, I don't know if he's the original bee, but there's a bumblebee in my driftwood.
That's a wonderful story.
Yes, wonderful story. Best story of the day, I think, Jane. Thank you so much for calling in. Let's go next to Scott in San Francisco. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First, just to follow up on one of the questions from your listeners about mechanical bees. There actually was a robo bee developed by Harvard robotics lab.
Oh, yes, I heard about that.
And it's, you know, it's certainly not out in our agricultural fields yet, but I can only imagine that Syngenta and Bayer are very interested in this study, and if they can demonstrate that they've got some economically viable alternative to bees, there may be less resistance to their products. But in any case, I wanted to point out that imidacloprid's toxicity, as we pointed out earlier, is long. It's like 3 years, and we need to remember that this stuff is in our food as well. And so we're consuming the same chemicals that were designed to kill insects. You'd asked about what changes we've observed as beekeepers, and I am a beekeeper based in San Francisco, and I'm actually finding some sources of optimism to the extent that beekeepers are representative of the broader agricultural systems. The beekeepers I know, of course, this is in the Bay Area, a little bit of maybe an exception nationally, but we're consistently decreasing the use of chemicals in our own hive maintenance, and that's a whole other debate, separate chemicals than the ones we're discussing on this call, but beekeepers are turning to more organic methods, and I'm hopeful, and I'm beginning to see that, you know, that's a trend in the broader agricultural system.
Well, yes, thank you so much for that, Scott, and thanks for bringing up this Robo Bee program at Harvard. I heard about this briefly and kind of didn't believe it, but it is true. And Amy, just 30 seconds, let's hope we don't get to the point where we have to use Robo Bees to pollinate crops.
I think you've said it. I think that's absolutely it. I mean, the miracle of watching that bumblebee in the backyard, noticing a 1 millimeter, 2 millimeter size green bee in your garden, we would lose so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for working to ensure that we don't get to that place and that we do save the bees. Amay Code is Pesticide Program Director at the Xerces Society, and Paul Towers is spokesman for the Pesticide Action Network. Thank you both for joining us, and thanks to all of you who called in and emailed. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Liz Cunningham about her new book, Ocean Country, One Woman's Journey from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas. Cunningham traveled the globe to discover how ocean conservation challenges are affecting people and their communities. She found vanishing coral reefs, collapsing fisheries, and species loss. But people are coming together to reverse this trend and save the seas. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.